So good afternoon. Welcome back. Now that we are fed and rested, we're going to begin the third session of the third and final session, which focuses on grassroots efforts and responses. I'm going to briefly introduce our panelists. As you know, there are fuller, although not full, biographies in your program. So presenting today are Dorian Warren, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science in the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. Janet Smith, who is associate professor of urban planning and the co-director of the Natalie P. Voorhees Center for Neighborhood and Community Involvement at the University of Illinois in Chicago.
Hi,
thanks for coming. Becky Navarro, Vanderlach Navarro, who's a doctoral candidate at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. Just arriving, Alderman Tony Preckwinkle, the fourth ward alderman in the city of Chicago. To her left, Matt McDermott, who is the senior organizer for the organization United Power and Justice, United Power for Action and Justice. And finally, Nancy Ardema, who is the executive director of the Logan Square Neighborhood Association. So welcome to the panelists. And
so can you hear me? I know the acoustics are strange in this room. So first I want to thank Professor Chaskin for inviting me here and making my mother very happy because she thinks I came home for Mother's Day and not to work. This is joint work with Virginia Parks, who's an assistant professor at SSA, and we're comparing the responses to Walmart store openings, the proposed Walmart store openings in Chicago and Los Angeles, although I'll be talking about Chicago today. And I just want to start out by saying that I could also make an argument both for and against Walmart, similar to Mary. Mary, we're going to steal that idea for our book. But instead, I want to focus today on, in this talk, on the community mobilization against Walmart in Chicago and what that signifies. So as most of you know, Walmart comes to Chicago in 2003-2004. And a big box battle ensues. And the Walmart battle in Chicago not only signal what we think is a significant change in Chicago politics as business as usual, but also it reflects a growing trend in grassroots political responses to economic inequality, broadly speaking. And so the story I'm going to tell raises several interesting and significant questions. Why Walmart? Why a conflict over Walmart? What can we learn about the community responses to Walmart, specifically, but more generally about big box retail developments? And what can we learn about the political responses to inequality in poor and working class communities of color from this conflict?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Now, it's important to note that Chicago is one of the first cases of political mobilization around Walmart in communities of color. There's a question about why there was this political mobilization that was very intense and conflict-laden, both in Chicago and Los Angeles. And what's interesting about this case is that we saw political mobilization when we least expect it. The research in urban politics and on political participation would not have predicted this level of response. The Chicago case is indicative of broader political responses to inequality and low-wage work at the local level over the last decade or so, and I'll say more about that in a few minutes. At the center of these political responses, whether living wage ordinances or community benefits agreements, are innovative labor community coalitions. Now, the Chicago case specifically reveals intra-racial divisions, that is, internal social and political divisions in black communities, especially under conditions of economic inequality. We can no longer think about the black community or black politics as a unified way. And this case of political contestation around low-wage work is important because it's a significant example of local attempts to regulate the low-wage labor market. Local political actors have tied together two often disparate policy arenas, employment on the one hand and economic development on the other. So I would like to introduce you briefly to Walmart, in case you're not familiar with Walmart. Let me just do a quick poll. Who in this room has been to a Walmart store? I'm assuming almost everybody. Mary? So Walmart, until 2 weeks ago, was the largest company in the world. It still is the world's largest employer, with 2 million employees in the U.S., 2 million employees worldwide, 1.4 million in the U.S. It's the largest employer in 25 states. It's the largest private employer of African Americans, Latinos, and women in the U.S. And the reason why I have that photo of the Earth and the Moon up there is because if you were to line up all 4,100 Walmart stores in the United States on top of each other, the resulting super, super Walmart would be the only human-made structure visible from the moon. Really enormous phenomenon. Walmart has more employees than ExxonMobil, Chevron, GM, ConocoPhillips, GE, Ford, Citigroup, Bank of America, and AT&T combined. So it's an enormous company and has a tremendous influence on the broader economy. It's also a dominant player in the U.S. retail sector. It's the largest food retailer, the largest toy store, the largest gun retailer, the third largest pharmacy, although pretty soon it will be the largest pharmacy. 82% of U.S. households made at least one purchase from Walmart in 2002, and on, you can see sort of the influence of Walmart. So just take my word for it that it's a dominant player, not only in the retail sector and in the economy, but increasingly in terms of its political influence, as you can see by the increase in its political contributions in just over a decade. Now, for most of its history, Walmart avoided the inner city, but it ultimately ran out of room in rural America, in the suburbs and exurbs, and that meant that the inner city was sort of the last or the final frontier for Walmart to expand. When Walmart, however, meets this final frontier, it also meets its first conflicts in large urban communities of color. And these conflicts are unique in that they involve explicit political claims around racial and economic inequality. Now, what I have on this slide is an announcement on April 4th, 2006, by the Walmart CEO at the time, Lee Scott, who proposed these Walmart jobs and opportunity zones, where Walmart was planning to build 50 new stores in 10 cities, the highest rates of unemployment, crime, etc. What's important is obviously the date of that announcement, April 4th, which is the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. Now, as I said, there have been several conflicts around Walmart in large urban communities of color, and I'm going to focus on Chicago today. What's important about the Chicago case, as well as the New York and LA cases, is that they're very different from other Walmart oppositions. So I want to put the Chicago conflict in context. So to give you a sense of the broader opposition mobilizations to Walmart, there have been over 400 anti-Walmart mobilizations across the country since the mid-1990s. It's about 10% of all of their U.S. stores. The vast majority of these oppositional mobilizations to Walmart are focused on NIMBY concerns, property values, traffic and safety, aesthetics, the effect of Walmart on local and small business owners, some environmental concerns, and they've mostly taken place in white, suburban, exurban, and working and middle class communities. Not many of these conflicts around Walmart have revolved around race, labor, or questions of inequality. That's what makes this case very different. So as I mentioned before, Walmart needed to expand to the city, and in many ways Walmart needs the city, but the question is, does the city need Walmart? We all have our own answers about this. But what's important about this question is that Walmart's indicative of the new low-wage service sector economy in urban America. We heard a lot about this in the first panel this morning, especially about the shift from deindustrialization to the service sector. And I think conflicts around Walmart might teach us something about the nature of community mobilization in urban politics in the 21st century. If Walmart is indeed the template for 21st century capitalism, in contrast to General Motors' role in the economy in the 20th century, this is according to historian Nelson Lichtenstein, then what are the possibilities for a redistributive or urban anti-poverty agenda in the new century? So I've told you a little bit about Walmart and opposition to Walmart stores generally. I want to now turn to the political context in which the Chicago conflict erupted. So first, it's important to note the two-dimensional crisis of work and black communities in the post-civil rights era. And this is the two-dimensional crisis is what Stephen Pitts calls one of unemployment and the second of low-wage work in black communities. Now, this is in the context of growing economic inequality in terms of income and wealth since the 1970s, deindustrialization, polarized job growth in the service sector. We also know a lot about political inequality and unequal political participation and political voice, and in fact, a range of studies have shown that whether you look at political participation, public opinion, the mobilization of interest groups or political organizations, there's incredible stratification by class, race, and gender. These inequalities are more dire in black communities. Kathy Cohen and Michael Dawson from the Political Science Department at University of Chicago found that in black communities, poor neighborhoods with higher concentrations of poverty, economic and social isolation are even much less likely to participate in politics or have their voices heard. Fred Harris showed that in the context of black political empowerment in the post-civil rights era, the effects of increased economic inequality during the same moment in time has actually depressed political voice and participation in black communities. So the increase in economic inequality has actually exacerbated the political inequalities in black communities. Yet even in this context of increasing economic inequality, reinforced in many ways by unequal political voice, there have been a wide and increasing number of redistributive claims being made at the local level. So for example, in response to federal inaction around economic inequality, for instance, the lack of an increase in the minimum wage from 1997 to 2007, states have taken up the cause of increasing the minimum wage. So as you see here, there were 17 states alone that raised the minimum wage in 2006. In 1998, only 7 states had a higher minimum wage than the federal wage rate. By 2009, 27 states had much higher minimum wages. We've also seen the proliferation of living wage campaigns. More than 140 living wage ordinances since 1994, more than 100 living wage campaigns on college campuses. We've seen something called community benefits agreements, which are these privately negotiated agreements between coalitions of community groups and labor unions and developers around big mega projects. So for those of you that are keeping track of the NBA playoffs, the Lakers are playing Houston at the Staples Center, which is considered one of the first successful community benefits agreements. All of these efforts, though, living wage ordinances, community benefits agreements, were being innovated way before the economic meltdown and recession. And what's important about these efforts are that they've rested on the organizing efforts and mobilizational efforts of labor community coalitions. And in that sense, cities and regions are now the crucial area or arena where the politics of inequality gets worked out. Okay, let me get back to Walmart in Chicago. So as you may remember, there were 2 proposed Walmart locations, one on the west side, one on the south side. The west side location has been open for quite a while now. And to give you a sense, those are the 2 proposed locations. Heavily black communities, as you can see quickly on this chart, on this map, as well as communities that either consist of high rates or are very close to neighborhoods with high rates of concentrated poverty. That's the location of the Walmart before it was built. It was actually a former Helene Curtis shampoo factory, which is a nice illustration of the shift from an industrial to a post-industrial city. And that's a picture of the actual new Walmart. So after this Walmart was built, or actually after it was approved by the city council in a very contentious zoning fight, this labor community coalition, led by the Grassroots Collaborative, led an effort to pass a big box living wage. And the debate became one about jobs versus good jobs. What the ordinance would have done, it would have applied to big box stores of over 90,000 square feet, would have mandated a wage of at least $10 an hour, plus $3 in benefits, phased in over 4 years, and most importantly, from my perspective, that most people don't realize about this bill, was that it included community hiring provisions and anti-discriminatory language, especially around hiring ex-offenders. So over 2 years from the moment this bill was introduced, there was mobilization on both sides, particularly in the black community. And here's a good illustration of the split within the black community in terms of who mobilized. So here you have Chicago Acorn members alongside Black Walmart associates. In terms of the folks that were pushing the big box living wage ordinance, this was a result of a very unique labor and community mobilization. As you can see here, they're Black community activists organizing as both residents as workers, as well as Black union members who are organizing as both workers and residents. And in their attempt to get this bill passed, they tried to draw upon a civil rights legacy that tried to join economic justice to racial justice. I think most of you probably remember what happened. After 2 years of mobilization, intense controversy, in July 2006, the City Council voted on the ordinance, 35 in favor, 14 against. What's interesting about this vote is that the Black Caucus split their votes, so 10 were in favor, 9 were against. But what I want to point out about this fact of the Black Caucus splitting their votes is that at least within the Black community, there is pretty widespread support for this ordinance. So in a public opinion poll taken both in June, before the ordinance passed, and then in August, after the ordinance passed, you can see here, Black support was 91.5% in June, dropped off a little bit after the debate, but that's still 4 to 5 African Americans in the city who are supportive of this ordinance. According to the same poll, when you actually look at the two major arguments that were part of the debate, so will this ordinance drive away the jobs and economic development that Chicagoans desperately need, versus should profitable retailers pay enough for families to make ends meet? Again, when faced with that zero-sum choice, especially among African Americans, there's much more support. 3 out of 4 Blacks said that they would prefer the living wage ordinance versus the argument about jobs and economic development. So at least in terms of popular opinion, there is relative unity in the Black community. It's a very different story in terms of Black political elites and how they voted in the City Council. So it passed in July. In September, after general silence on the issue, Mayor Daley issued his first, and I think this is correct, his only veto thus far in his 20-year tenure in the City Council. He's able to flip a few aldermen, and so they can't override the veto. And I want to try to sum up in the remaining 3 minutes I have and tell you a little bit about how Virginia and I are making sense of this conflict, why people mobilized around Walmart, how and why the bill got passed, and why it ultimately failed based on the mayor's veto. So very quickly, there are 4 pieces to the puzzle we think are important. The first is the context of racialized economic development in the city, and especially in these neighborhoods. All of us know, we've talked about it all day long, we know about the legacy and contemporary experience of race, class, and urban development, where neighborhoods of color have very high rates of unemployment and concentrated poverty. Disinvestment over many, many years, creating both food deserts as well as good job deserts. And so this is the context in which Walmart entered the city, and this is the context in which this debate played out, this broader legacy of inequality, disinvestment, etc. A second important component of the story is the nature of Chicago's political institutions, and this becomes very clear when you look comparatively at other cities like Los Angeles. No one will be surprised, even though we all accept it, I do as a Chicago native, that we live in a city where you could argue it's undemocratic and that power is very centralized in the mayor's office. The development process itself tends to be very opaque, relative, again, compared to other cities. And generally, there's limited political voice of local residents in development decisions, broadly speaking. A third factor is the nature of the political mobilization and how it played out in this conflict. Now, what's important about the nature of the political mobilization around this is that historically we've understood big cities to have city what are called city trenches, in Ira Katz Nelson's term. That is, white workers historically were organized in the labor unions, Black residents were historically organized in the community organizations at the neighborhood level, and these created city trenches that prevented effective action across these divides. We think that what happened in this campaign was sort of a bridging of this historic city trench, so to speak. That is, ACORN and union members begin to fill in those trenches. Union members mobilize as union members and as neighborhood residents. Community residents organize around labor or employment issues. So there is an innovative and unique coalition that came together around this issue. And in some ways, though, this meant that a new city trench was highlighted. That is, the trench within the black community, the division within the black community on this issue. So we know on both sides there are black churches, black church leaders, black community leaders who took both positions. On the national level, both positions on the Walmart question is illustrated by Andy Young and Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jackson, who was opposed to Walmart, Andy Young, who was actually hired by Walmart to promote Walmart's entry into black communities. And I have some good quotes, but I'll leave those for later. But this is something we have to take into account, especially in an age of Obama, that there will be more and more and increasing conflicts within black communities on a range of issues, whether it's housing or employment, etc. Last but not least, what's important about this story are the political frames that were used in the public debate. So whether one views the entry of big box stores as an invasion or investment depends upon the outcome of framing contests and political conflicts. Frames, how people understand and frame issues, are used by political actors to advance a policy proposal, to mobilize key constituents, to persuade a broader public of their position. What we want to say about the framing in this debate is that these are the four major frames that were used in the news coverage on the local news as well as in the newspapers. The dominant frame was a jobs and development frame. That is, advocates of Walmart argue that Walmart's entry should be welcomed by the city because of the jobs and development it would provide. Opponents of Walmart offered a bad jobs frame. What was interesting about the third frame is this white labor versus black community, and this newspaper cover illustrates this, where it says daily, unions box out blacks. That implies that there are no black people in unions, and it implies that the black community was somehow unified on this issue. Where, even though I've offered evidence that at the mass opinion level that might be true, in terms of the political elite level, that's not true. But this framing of white unions versus the black community, it makes certain folks invisible. It makes black union members who mobilize around this issue invisible. And it makes the actual divisions within black communities invisible. It's important to how we understand the ultimate outcome of this debate. One last slide. I'll wrap up with three implications of this story. The first is that, in light of increasing demands for redistribution being made at the local level, there's a question about under what conditions can local communities, can residents and workers advance an anti-poverty agenda at the urban level. We actually know a lot about the effects of inequality on political mobilization and voice, the adverse effects of inequality on political mobilization. But we don't know so much about the effects of political mobilization on inequality. What kinds of political responses have been effective at decreasing economic inequality over the last 10 years? Secondly, I've mentioned a little bit about these intra-racial divisions, which I think we'll see much more of as in the future, in the 21st century. Again, I highlighted the unified public opinion in the black community on the one hand, but the divided community mobilization around Walmart on the other. And last but not least, this case raises questions about a city's ability to extract concessions from capital for redistribution demands. It depends on if cities and regional entities have the political authority to do so, but it also depends upon what type of capital is at play here. Service sector capital, Walmart, is very different from industrial capital. And that's our experience in Chicago in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, where industry led, there was capital flight. There weren't a lot of levers available to local residents to keep capital here, to keep jobs here. We're in a very different place now, where Walmart wants to come into the city, so does Target. And so that means that there's a different kind of leverage that community groups and residents have to say, well, these are the conditions under which you'll come into our communities. And finally, I think what's important about this story is that community and labor organizations and coalition have punctured the long-held assumption that cities can't redistribute or cities can't do anything about urban poverty. Instead, they're innovating new strategies, new tactics, and relationships with each other to push for agendas around social justice at the local level. Thank you.
Anyway, thank you very much. Thank you for being invited. I'm sorry I didn't get to join you earlier and spend the rest of the day with you to hear the earlier talks, but I actually just came from a really interesting discussion with some folks from New Orleans and talking about what's happening between the two cities. And so they're sort of influencing even this talk today because I'm going to talk a little bit about the right to the city, which is where that conversation was coming from. So I don't remember who gave me the title for this talk, but whoever did, thank you very much. It fits very well with what I wanted to talk about. I put up here as sort of a disclaimer, so I'm co-director of the Natalie P. Voorhees Center for Neighborhood and Community Improvement. We do a lot of work, and what I'm going to draw on today in my comments come from that work. They come from work with communities that come to us seeking assistance around a whole range of things, whether it's housing, whether it's gentrification issues, whether it's economic development. They come looking for assistance, usually in the form of data and other ways in terms of technical assistance. I also put up this little note that we have a nice little part of our website that actually talks about gentrification. So if you want to go to see when I talk about gentrification, what we mean by that and how we operationalize it, you can go to our website for that. I'm going to bring in some things, too, that I teach community development at UIC. And if I had given this talk at the beginning of the semester when I was starting my community development practice class, I don't think it would be the same as it is today because I think I've grown a lot from my students and in the energy that they're bringing to the classroom today. So I'm glad I'm doing this now and then it was not in January. So in terms of what I'm going to go through is I'm going to give you a little bit of a framework as to how I'm going to talk about what's going on and sort of looking at this as sort of a historical moment. I could get hysterical too, but historical moment of change and, you know, no pun intended, that was literally meant, you know, everyone's using the word, but also looking at how things have changed in the last 40 years around community development broadly and in particular looking at it in the context and lens of gentrification and the broader context of neoliberalism and such. I'm going to present some evidence that will help kind of look at where we're at, noting that my punchline really is I don't have an answer. This isn't a research study on where we're at. This is let's look at this and try and draw some conclusions, and hopefully we'll all be able to finish that together today and have some conclusions that can be of use to all of us. And then some analysis before that, obviously. So guiding my work are sort of three related bits of literature. First is my friend Kathy Newman and Bob Lake's recent work looking at community development. They wrote a really lovely piece two years ago looking at community development and sort of saying, where have we come from? Where are we going since 1968? And, you know, for those of us who know, 1968 becomes this romantic date in sort of community development legend, but it's sort of back when Manuel Castells was writing about what was going on. And sort of this sort of, and it is somewhat sometimes romanticized, but sort of the grassroots organizing, the kind of feelings of where we could go and where we could change. But as Kathy and Bob note here, and sort of highlighting that in the white letters, if you will, sort of the end of democratic redistributive phase of community development. So this is context. This is where we're at. I'm going to take as a given the sort of neoliberalism criteria for understanding our world. I'm not sure if I always agree with neoliberalism, and my friend Nick in the back, we can have a fight over a beer later about this, but at least in terms of the evidence of neoliberalism, we see it in the day-to-day work that communities are dealing with right now. And so it's this idea that the redistributive phase of community development has come to an end, and so the question of where we're at. But they also note this sort of opening, if you will, an opening of a chance, maybe an opportunity to sort of look again to where we're going with community development and our work with new purpose and to look at it through a lens of social action and social justice. I also borrow from folks in this room, so from Bill Seitz and Rob and Virginia, and their work on looking at a recent piece that they did in Journal of Urban Affairs in terms of looking at community development, again, the 21st century, where are we going, where have we been, sort of raising some cautions about some things that we can maybe lock ourselves into and lose opportunities. But what I really liked is this concept of positive transgressions. My students liked it too, and we used it in class the other day. But to kind of think about, basically everything is about breaking down boundaries. Community development has often been criticized of being myopic, focusing in, not focusing out, not looking at the sort of stream of things, the chain, the supply chain, if you will, of how things happen in our communities. Many communities now are very sophisticated to the understanding of globalization, whether it hit them hard when, you know, they started realizing the markets were collapsing and understanding that mortgages weren't even, you know, held by the local bank, or if it was even earlier with that, with people doing sophisticated analysis of, you know, Starbucks and such like that showing up in their neighborhoods. But this idea that we have to kind of look up and down the scale, look outside, but also cross boundaries and to unite with people who are, in the case we were hearing earlier about the big box, are often fighting against each other or seemingly being framed as this community against that, to actually say, how do we work together? So I think that is another important sort of transition or sort of crossroads we're at. I also want to talk about it, that the previous slide, though, suggests almost a neutral framing. That is, you know, we cross some boundaries and we can kind of bring together a mix of people and we can get some things done. My view of that is it's not a neutral position. It's actually a deliberative and strategic move, and it's more in the spirit of this statement, which is about how do we look at power and how do we understand it. And so it's really where it's with the purpose of not just power analysis, which is always strategic when community groups do this, but it's also to understand it with the intent and then sort of in the spirit of the Right to the City movement of how do we work, understand that power, and how do we get sort of changes occurring in our community given those power structures, and how do we then also do it in a way that we get to stay in the city, and that's been a big issue about the ability to stay put. So I want to just kind of give you the quick rundown of the last 40 years in one slide. And with pictures. So on your left is a house. And if you on the left is a house. It symbolizes where community development has gone and where it's come from. Community development 40 years ago, if you go back to some of the big projects that were going on where you had the growth, of the beginning, the birth, if you will, of the CDCs, the Community Development Corporation movement, you found these organizations that were basically coming in and doing triage and saying, what do we do in these communities? Nothing's being provided. Services are missing. Government isn't there. We need to do something. We need to do everything. So that's phase one. Concurrently, you have sort of organizing going on at the same time. I'm going to talk about that as a second sort of phase, but let me go through the CDC period. First, when we start to look at CDCs, they start to grow, and they become actually the replacement, if you will, in cities, in some neighborhoods of government. In the second phase, which is really we start to look at the 1980s during the Reagan administration when government basically scaled back all its investment in community development and housing, or not all, there was a little bit still left, but most of it, you know, we see a scaling back. We see a reaction. We see states actually becoming bigger players around affordable housing, for example. We see the boom of a new generation of nonprofits coming out to do affordable housing development and community development. So that's the 1990s, and so we're living with the legacy of the 1990s, by the way, which in the next 2 years we're probably not going to see as many community development corporations as we did because of different things that have changed in the last year or so in the market. But in the third phase, which is where we're at now, we've become an industry. Community development is an industry. I have students who graduate who get jobs. Well, knock on wood, they're getting jobs in the business of community development. They get trained in a particular way. They learn certain things. You know, and so we have a sort of what we call an industry where we have you know, over 5,000 community development corporations out there doing business of community development. So I put up the other side our pictures of sort of organizers in two different positions and sort of saying there's two strains and they're still operating concurrently. So they're not a linear as much as they're a parallel track. We can always, you know, we have to remember because we're from Chicago, but in terms of Saul Alinsky and sort of the rules for radicals and the kind of organizing, where, you know, it's about the big issue, you go in for the big fight, you organize in a particular way. But concurrently, we saw the rise of sort of the Freirean, you know, the popular education, the really the grassroots, just, you know, not about solving, not about winning the issue, sort of the big box issue, for example, but about educating people and organizing people around and, you know, the issues that they care about. So this is our context. This is also our context. So those other context points were really about, in broad sweep, anywhere you could go in the country, you can talk about community development having these tracks. You can talk about organizing having these tracks. We have to situate Chicago, though, and I'm going to talk about the context of Chicago. And I didn't put these up just because I had these fun pictures, but why not? But it was also just to say that we have to remember that the mayors have been very influential. I mean, it's really funny. I moved away. I was born when the first Mayor Daley was here. I moved away when we had Harold Washington, and I came back to the second mayor. And I always forget, you know, that I know there are other mayors in between, but we have to remember, many people, you know, one of the things, it's no offense to them, you know, it's that I had their pictures. But if we think about this, a lot of people always, you know, sort of talked about where was Harold Washington going before he died in terms of, you know, the sort of the neighborhood movement. And so when I put up neighborhood politics here, each of these mayors represents a particular form of neighborhood politics. We don't need to go into the analysis, but there's always a neighborhood politics in Chicago, right? I mean, we just have to remember that that works that way, and that the mayor's role and the aldermen, as we have Alderman Preckwinkle here, we, you know, we have to think about that relationship. It's a very strong, powerful relationship. We also have to think about gentrification, and this is where I want to kind of take us to think, you know, just where we're going. As they put it, gentrification is global. You know, that's kind of a cute phrase, but it does. This picture is actually a really good one. Because not only does it show UIC, which we have a role in what's happening, this is in Pilsen, you know, about some of these developments that were going on down here. This represents, it's supposed to represent sort of the international capital, if you will, the role of big business in this, in that the partnerships that came together to form this development come from, you know, California annuity funds, they come from a, you know, former person who was head of HUD, they come from, you know, all these different sort of parties to the process of building a development, which is empty still. That lot is empty. If you look at this, the sign down at the bottom, no yuppies, that's sort of a reaction to Coldwell Banker being there, but this is the sort of collection of what used to be, I think we have to really edit it out, of banks that used to exist, that used to fund a lot of this kind of development, that, you know, suddenly in the 1990s we started seeing banks realize that there were neighborhoods to come back to. So Washington Mutual started appearing in our neighborhoods. We started seeing a lot of banks, and I'm just picking that as one, you know, started to show up in our neighborhoods to actually lend to communities that, you know, prior years they were disinvesting. They've discovered, they're called the emerging markets, right? So there's that, and then on the far right, just is an image of from Pilsen and from the Pilsen Alliance and organizing around the campaign of Pilsen is not for sale. So what you see is gentrification. It's not your grandma's gentrification anymore. It's not what we remember, where the individual comes in and they're going to be, you know, I'm going to fix up this home and I'm going to stay here. It's not that. It's not the yuppie. In fact, it's really big business. And this is what communities are facing and trying to figure out how to work against, with, or both. We also have to, and you heard it already, that race still matters. And this isn't just in Chicago, because I just came from talking about it in New Orleans. But it is critical in Chicago to remember the sort of racial, spatial patterns that we have. And so this is a sort of, this is a sign, if anyone remembers, this is around the corner from Cabrini Green as it was being redeveloped. It's for Kohler Bath. But the urban renewal was a little too, I think, close to the bone for some people in that neighborhood who had been there 40 years ago when urban renewal was going on. But what we have to remember is sort of this idea that if race still matters, there's this image too. I had to put this up because it's one of my favorite images to kind of talk about this idea of the shifting, the movement of people. And there was a lot of discussion in the 1990s, academic research in particular, of how do we bring people back to the city. Some people in the communities that I work with and in have talked about it in a particular way of how do we bring white people back into the city, into communities where I'm at, and as a black person might not be able to stay. So this is called the Vast White Ring Conspiracy. I'll just let it sit there for a minute and you can read it. It plays on, you know, I figured, I'm at the, you know, University of Chicago, we got to have concentric ring zones, you know, University of Chicago sociology, right? But it is also, it was, I mean, this was a major piece that was put up. This wasn't just a little fluff cartoon. This was actually a Brookings Institution publication to symbolize and talk about this issue. What we were seeing is in the movement back into cities of people, and it wasn't just a back to the city movement, it was a deliberate strategic pulling back in as well by policymakers. Then there's this image. This is from the tearing down of Robert Taylor homes, and it's one that is very powerful, I think, just to sort of asking the question of whose home is it, whose place is it for us to stay. Again, reflecting the voices of people that I talk to through our work at Public Housing Residence, through our work with people in West Hubble Park who are dealing with gentrification, through different communities that I'm working with of color in particular who are asking whose community is this and whose city is this. So I want to just sort of summarize where I think we're at this crossroads. So I give you this context and these kind of things and that are happening, and there's data all behind this if you want to, you know, to get into it. But the most important thing is I've been trying to make sense of the reactions that we get. And I think this is, you know, we earlier Dorian was saying about, you know, you could be on one side of the big box and you could be on the other side. I'm this way with where we're going with community development. On one side, and I don't mean this as to be disrespectful about acquiescence, but what I do see is that there are people who are just, you know, staying the course in community development. That is, that course being we're going to continue affordable housing development, that's our dominant, you know, that's our bread and butter, that's our business, that's what we know, despite the fact you can't do a low-income housing tax credit deal, despite the fact you can't get property, despite all these things, that's, we're going to stay the course. You have other groups, though, and we heard about it with some of the discussion around the Olympics this spring. We heard it with some of the other things around the big box ordinance. How do we change the rules of engagement? So what you see is groups, so for example, around, and I'm not trying to bring this up, Alderman Preckwinkle, because I know it was a touchy issue, but the benefits agreement, for example, that was being discussed is an example of what's happening around the country. Residents are trying to get to extract and make sure that they get from the deal that's being cut something in return, and legally something binding, because they've been promised many things. So they're looking for something that says, you're obligated to give us this, and if you don't, we have a binding agreement to hold you accountable for that. We also, though, have things like land trusts. We worked with the first community land trust in the whole state of Illinois, which was not in Chicago. It was in Highland Park. Highland Park, Illinois. This is a tool that can do affordable help with affordable housing. But the community land trust is about owning the land. Why do people want to own the land? The argument is that we can control even more what goes on in our neighborhood. And so what you see is Highland Park did it more from an affordable housing perspective, but the first community land trust of Chicago, which we worked with in West Humboldt Park, did it because they said, we see gentrification coming down Chicago Avenue at us. We have the developers coming to us trying to buy us out. We want to do something different. We want to be able to stay in our community. We want to control it. We want to set the rules for engagement. So that's what I would say is adaptation, because it's still working in the confines of the rules, which are weak capitalism and such, and that development happens, but we're going to make sure it's controlled. The second side is where I see this sort of emerging strategies, and they're not even that emerging, because I think we could say we're maybe coming full circle back to 1968 in ways. So there's organizing, which is the classic kind of thing to talk about, but it's in a particular way that I'm going to end on sort of talking through that we see in terms of resistance, restructuring, reframing, and reclaiming. We also have a movement with human rights, and it's really growing a lot in the United States. Part of it has been around police brutality, but it's become a very strong galvanizing point for people in the affordable housing arena. And so we've had Maloun Khatouri, for example, who's the special rapporteur from the United Nations, come to Chicago to look at what was happening in public housing in 2004 and declare this something that we should not replicate anywhere else in the world, yet Chicago is an example, and he was very disturbed by what he saw. So you have this attention to Chicago because of the kind of things that, in particular, human rights violations being raised, as well as the whole idea of forced evictions, and that's the language people are using to talk about public housing redevelopment or neighborhood displacement. You have then also this notion of a right to city, the right to the city movement, which is really not something just from the United States that's happening around the world. And I'm not saying I'm buying into it completely. Intellectually, it's very interesting, but how it operationalizes is the biggest question. So I just had to put this image up because the whole thing in land we trust, or in the land trust concept. This, if anyone has ever seen this is from a little art project some folks did called Chaos a couple of years ago. It was a play on the Chicago Housing Authority change. But they said, what would it look like if we took the same land, a land mass for the CHA property, and we did it in Lincoln Park instead of displacing people from Cabrini or the south side of Chicago. And it's meant to jolt you, to get you to think about what this means. And this is where residents are coming from. They're thinking about it from the perspective of, we want to control this because you have control with your land. We don't as renters, for example, or we don't as public housing residents. So you can see this urgency of needing control of land and why that becomes important to people. But there are a lot of people who have been organizing, and you know, these are images fresh from a couple weeks ago about fighting back. You name it, they're fighting back on something, whether it's the better clinics, when they were talking about closing the clinics down on the south side, to people who are fighting. Obviously, there's about the CEO, there's people about big box, et cetera. And it's these terms of sort of engagement that become interesting, because then there's this. So this image is of the people who were protesting when the IOC came, and this is where you start to see transgressions, if you will. I'm not sure if they're positive. They may be just dissidents. But so you have the police out there, right? And this is fascinating to me because my brother's a cop, for one thing. He wasn't out there, I know that. So you have Daley doesn't protect your neighborhood. The language of the police protest, who are doing this because they don't have a contract. You know how protests work, right? You have a protest event around an issue, and then everyone else shows up with their issue. And so what becomes interesting is how this IOC event became a way to strategically position themselves, the police in this case. The reason I put this image up, I'm sure there's a way to point, but I don't know how to do the lace thing. The image on the top right is actually a group particular that is concerned about the IOC's visit because they're looking at it from a human rights violation. They're looking at it particularly from the fact that under the idea of police brutality in Chicago, we should not have the games come here, period, because we're in violation of human rights. And that is actually something that can prevent, or should prevent, some people would argue, the Olympics coming. So I'm not trying to argue the Olympics one side or the other. I'm just trying to make sense of these events. Because then you also have people down on the far, on the bottom left, who are people clearly not from the community that they are holding signs up in support of the Olympics. The reframing piece, and you don't have to read all these words, but what's fascinating to me is the way people are looking back and coming forward. They're looking back for language to say what we should be doing. So they're quoting people like Harry Truman. This comes off of a social economic justice group's website that does a lot of work around public housing as a human right. And they're looking back at Franklin Roosevelt. But then J.R., who is an organizer here in Chicago, and some people know him, good, bad, or otherwise, J.R. is talking real about what's going on now, and he's saying the demolitions have destroyed the economic, social, and cultural networks of our community. Our community was made of families, and these families were dependent on these networks, so they basically removed one of the key elements for social stability. He's talking about the demolition of housing. But I point this out is because here is this sort of, we're looking for a framing and how to make sense of what's going on in our cities, but whereas, you know, Truman and Roosevelt are saying, you know, no housing program can be adequate or complete if it fails to provide for any substantial segment of the community. So there's a statement there, but we've never had behavior that even reflects that remotely. So the reclaiming, I'm not going to read this all, but this is a statement from residents of Grove Park, who after the statement in the Boston Globe that raised all this contention about how Barack Obama was going to do housing, they said, you know what, put that aside, listen to us, listen to what we did, which was we got a developer in, and you know, of course they're going to claim more than maybe they did, but they're claiming their work. They're trying to claim what they did in the community to get back that development, to be able to stay in the community after a long fight with many, many big agencies around this and sitting again around the table trying to figure out how we could strategically help them. Which leads us to this idea of the right to the city. And I just want to point out that this is where people are framing it in more bolder terms. This isn't about a right to housing. Now we're saying we have a right to stay put, we have a right to own land and keep it in public hands, we have a right to make sure that we have all these different justices invoked. And so what we have to ask, though, is given these conditions, so where we're at, this is the questions or the conclusions I keep coming to. Currently, we have both of these categories existing. That is the sort of social justice, kind of aggressive organizing work going on, but at the same time sort of, whether it's complacency or whatever, going on. And they're concurrently happening, and they're causing friction and dissidence. In communities. So you can go to Pilsen, you can see this playing out, for example. You also have then this idea of the housing market collapse. Everyone's saying it's really creating a good opportunity for us to think about what we're doing in terms of community development. And I think, you know, not to be a Rahm Emanuel about, you know, trying to take advantage of a good, you know, these situations, but we do have to think about how this does create opportunities for us to talk differently about what we mean by community development. So broadening out away from just affordable housing development. And then finally, how do we reframe this idea of social justice? So many people see it as socialism and social taking from me and giving to you. How do we reframe it so that it is really about democracy and rights and actually negative rights? That is, don't take from me. I'm not asking for your stuff. I want to make sure I can keep my stuff. So I'm going to end at that point because I went over as it is. Thanks. So I want to give a great thanks to Dr. Rob Chaskin and other organizers today of this symposium. It's really been an honor to be here. The title of my project today is Chicago's Mexican Immigrant HTAs and U.S.-focused contention, moving beyond transnational conceptualizations. And this research is based on my larger dissertation project, and I want to give great thanks to my advisor, Dr. William Seitz, who's been an incredible support through my process. And I want to give special thanks to Chicago's HTA Leadership Coalition, CONFAMEX, that I'll talk about today, and other grassroots activists in Chicago who've made this research possible. So I'm going to begin by explaining what are Mexican Immigrant Hometown Associations, or HTAs, and how they've been understood in the research. And then I'll get into how HTAs have evolved and present my own research agenda and a new set of theoretical tools to better understand HTAs, and then present some of my own preliminary findings. With the dramatic increase of Mexican immigration to the U.S., there is growing public and academic debate surrounding immigrants' political incorporation. The many Mexican hometown associations, referred to as HTAs, in U.S. cities have been recognized as important forms of first-generation Mexican immigrant voluntary civic and political participation at the grassroots level. Much like mutual aid societies for past immigrants, an HTA is a group of immigrants from the same hometown of Mexico who form a club here in the U.S. Much of the research on HTAs is focused on their ability to sustain transnational ties to their Mexican society. And this can be through cultural events to celebrate their Mexican identity and heritage.
and HDAs have received an increasing amount of scholarly attention for raising money to send back to their homeland for infrastructure development projects, whether it's paving a road or building a school back in their pueblo. And by the end of the 1990s and into 2000, various levels of the Mexican government began to match HTA's donations for local development projects, evolving into what is now referred to as the 3-to-1 or a 3-por-1 project, where for every dollar that's donated by an HTA, you've got the municipal, state, and national government of Mexico donating a dollar. HTAs have been known to contribute anywhere from $10,000 to as much as $100,000 towards development projects back in their homeland, which is a significant amount for a Mexican pueblo. Along with their economic power, some HTAs have even garnered political power, influencing local elections back in Mexico. Because of the Mexican state outreach to its diaspora in the U.S., played out largely through Mexican consulates, HTAs in the Midwest region, Illinois, Wisconsin, Northern Indiana, have grown tremendously in number, from just 34 in 1995 to more than 340 in 2008. Yet recent activities in Chicago, including unified HTA leadership of the dramatic 2006 marches for immigrant rights, suggest that this kind of organization has the potential to transform into a significant agent of U.S. political incorporation for its immigrant base, as well as maintain its transnational ties to Mexican society. Predominant research, however, has underestimated HTA's potential to serve as contentious organizations in response to U.S. government threats. So how is it that Chicago's traditionally Mexican-focused HTA coalition was motivated to take a leadership role in U.S.-focused contentious action? Recent theories influenced by the transnationalist lens do not effectively explain HTA's shift to U.S. contention because they fail to pay adequate attention to the U.S. political environment and how it has come to influence HTA activism. Using a social movement approach, I argue that Chicago HTA's recourse to U.S.-centered contention is best understood as a response to various state actors on both sides of the Mexico-U.S. border. In particular, I focused on first, the enhanced political legitimacy conferred upon the Chicago HTA Confederation, CONFAMEX, by the Mexican government's diaspora reincorporation programs, and by Chicago-based consular support. Second, and more important, I explore the combined impacts of a threatening post-9/11 U.S. anti-immigrant politics and a quite different and yet powerfully legitimating set of Illinois state government programs that courted Chicago-based Mexican HTAs as attractive voting blocks. In order to construct this argument, my study draws on several years of ethnographic participant observation from June 2005 to June 2007. It also draws on archival data and 32 key informant interviews with Chicago's HTA leadership coalition, as well as with several grassroots organizers, Illinois state government, and Mexican officials. Moving beyond transnational conceptualizations of HTAs, the social movement paradigm is especially useful to highlight the opportunities, threats, and tensions Chicago's HTA leadership coalition faces as its political agenda grows to include both Mexico and U.S.-oriented political activity. Social movement theorists have derived general agreement around the following conceptions of social mobilization: political opportunities and threats, and this looks at the essential role of the state in configuring collective insurgency. And in the case of Chicago HTAs, this refers to political opportunities and threats in both Mexico and the U.S. Mobilizing structures, and these are the daily network connections or formal organizations that can transform into resources for collective action. Cultural framing processes, the active use of language and symbols by protesters to construct how they view an issue and to evoke an emotional response. Framing also considers activist orientation and scale of action. And lastly, repertoires of contention, the strategies or actions a group employs at any given moment, whether it's marches, vigils, or violence. In the case of recent immigrant mobilizations, it is widely recognized that national policy proposals in the U.S., In particular, the threatening provisions of the Sensenbrenner Bill served as a crucial catalyst. But by employing a social movement paradigm, this study is able to unpack the complex relationship between government action and immigrant agency that led up to the 2006 marches. In response to the political opportunity structures extended by the Mexican government to immigrant HTAs during the 1990s, the organizations quickly grew in number and began to serve as important support networks for both documented and undocumented immigrants, and potential channels for both conventional and unconventional political participation, focused largely on Mexican concerns. Between the short years of 1994 and 2003, the number of Chicago HTAs grew dramatically, from 35 to 170. Fortifying their economic and political standing during the decade, organized immigrants in Chicago began to coalesce into state-level federations and expand their political demands within Mexican politics as they fought to create their own autonomy from Mexican government officials when implementing development projects. And they also began to promote at a national level dual citizenship rights and absentee voting rights in Mexican elections. Current research, and also during this time, the Chicago Mexican Consulate grew to serve as an important initial broker with the resources to captivate new arrivals and encourage HTA participation and growth. Current research, largely driven by the transnationalist lens, still generally focuses on HTAs and their relationship to the Mexican state. Following the attacks of September 11, 2001, the U.S. political environment increasingly transformed into a political threat due to its subsequent securitization and criminalization approach to immigrant concerns. As the U.S. political environment turned punitive, Chicago HTAs began to respond through a development of a confederated entity, CONFEMEX, the Confederation of Mexican Federations, which served to integrate 179 HTAs and 9 federations, and at its largest have come to represent 270 HTAs in the Chicagoland area. And they explicitly had a broader organizational agenda to include both Mexico and U.S. related concerns. And then CONFEMEX soon joined with a multi-scalar alliance of immigrant-led organizations throughout the U.S., the National Alliance of Latino and Caribbean Communities, NALAC. Their coalition building accelerated Chicago HTA's identity transformation as immigrants with an intensifying optimism and sense of power that together they could create change in U.S. immigrant policy. The HTA coalition of CONFEMEX was slowly gaining a sense of political efficacy and U.S. concerns, and as a consequence, deliberately reframed their scale of action and orientation from Mexican-oriented concerns to include making claims in U.S. national politics. CONFEMEX's interest in U.S.-based affairs was further encouraged when the local Illinois government extended local political opportunities to CONFEMEX leaders to serve within a public-private community alliance to promote immigrant integration initiatives in Illinois. Democratic Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich was keenly aware of the growing political clout of the state's vastly expanding Latino immigrant community. Indeed, this was an important voting block that helped solidify his election win in 2002. So as a means to accommodate the loyalty of Latino community leaders, on November 19, 2005, Blagojevich signed the New American Executive Order as a means to promote immigrant integration. And this also included a task force and an expansion in state services to immigrants, regardless of their legal status. The plan even included an Illinois Immigrant Welcoming Center that would come to fruition later in 2006. While in the midst of CONFEMEX's advocacy for Mexican absentee voting rights, Governor Blagojevich looked to a charismatic and articulate Mexican immigrant CONFEMEX leader from the state of Michoacán to become the director of the Governor's Office of New American Policy and Advocacy. The new connection to the local state would inspire future U.S.-focused interest group activity and electoral participation for various federation leaders. Blagojevich's outreach to the immigrant community would only expand in future months during the marches as he aimed to capitalize on the growing political consciousness of an immigrant community demonstrated in their battle cry, "Hoy marchamos, mañana votamos. Today we march, tomorrow we vote." Eventually, HTA's emerging immigrant rights consciousness would deeply collide with the dramatic shift in U.S. politics in December of 2005, when the highly contentious and punitive H.R. 4437, sponsored by James Sensenbrenner, speedily passed through the House of Representatives. The bill considered unauthorized immigration. conviction a felony offense and even criminalized individuals or organizations who knowingly aid undocumented immigrants. Transnational activists, long-standing campaign for Mexican voting rights, which was a historic measure in and of itself, was quickly shelved in the wake of such an oppressive U.S. measure. A Federation leader described to me the deep insult they felt with Sensenbrenner and how this Federation became motivated to fight. He said, "It hit them so bad. The proposal was so discriminatory that we took it personally. Because before, when you heard about anything on the television, yeah, but that is happening there in Washington. It is very far. But when you begin to see that it is going to affect the doctor that treats your brother, that doesn't have documents, when you see that it's going to be the teacher that gives classes to the next kid that is undocumented, you say, screw this, this is bad. We have to change it. We have to do something." And the people were very attentive. I believe there was a certain level of consciousness. With the passing of the Sensenbrenner bill, the focus of transnational, generally non-confrontational, compromise and its HTA base abruptly changed as they reappropriated into mobilizing structures, with the Michoacan headquarters serving as Chicago's central planning hub. And they began to widen the repertoire of contention to include U.S.-focused mass mobilization. COMPOMEX worked extensively with various Chicago grassroots organizers and churches, and consequently, Chicago's immigrant community provided the first mobilization in the country to respond to the Sensenbrenner bill on March 10, 2006, with a massive yet peaceful demonstration in the city's downtown. Estimates vary between 100,000 to 150,000 protesters. A COMPOMEX leader described the impact of the marches and their organizational agenda as follows. "It gave us a lot of strength and energy to continue working. I believe that now we have more responsibility than before. If you're going to rouse the people, if you're going to teach them, if you're going to tell them to talk about their rights, you also have to teach them what are their rights. This is a responsibility that has come upon us. We have changed a little our vision that we had in the beginning, that was nothing more than Mexico. We are showing the people that they should vote for the U.S. And I think we've had a lot of impact, because there are a lot of people that are U.S. residents for many years and nothing more. And we have shown that you're not losing Mexico when you become a U.S. citizen. In fact, we are winning as Federation. I think the marches help us to understand that we can be American citizens and work in two countries." The March 10, 2006 rally brought a new energy to COMPOMEX, a sense of political advocacy in U.S. affairs, and a new sense of responsibility to promote the U.S. political incorporation of their base. It's also important to note that larger, national-level Latino organizations did not instigate the idea of a demonstration, nor did they have the connection to the grassroots community to support it. One transnational Mexican political party organizer claimed national organizers were caught flat-footed because institutions can't move past them. In addition, there was also very minimal representation of labor unions in the first March 10th Congress. Unions are also relatively more structured and bureaucratic, which caused them to move more slowly, and they could not make a move until right before the march. Transnational Mexican-oriented activists interviewed for the study who worked closely with unions claimed that organized labor did not know how big the March 10th demonstration was going to be and its importance for immigrants. The loosely connected grassroots group of organizers that came together for the March 10th planning did not have a clear uniform identity other than being anti-Sensenbrenner. They were more of a spontaneous force whose faces were comprised of mixed legal status and consequential, which faced firsthand the dire outcomes of this newly passed legislation. The initial mega march on March 10th was so quickly organized that it included homemade signs. Relatively little money was spent on it, and it was put together quickly. Most of the organizers did not have important links to the dominant U.S. institutions that were making the judgment call so detrimental to their daily lives. Indeed, it was outside of long-standing dominant institutions that immigrant organizers close to the trenches were activated to create political claims and marshal collective insurgency. The organic grassroots feel of the March 10, 2006 demonstration would gradually diminish in the immigrant rallies that would come to follow as more institutionalized groups would become involved in the movement. COMPOMEX's crucial role in organizing the March 10th rally also gave its organizers new standing as emergent leaders in U.S.-focused immigrant organizing. A fellow key activist of the mobilization, the director of Centro Sin Fronteras, talked of HTA's leadership as follows. "They were finally rolling up their sleeves and getting involved with people on this side of the border. They're going to continue to grow and have power in this history, all these adults as U.S. children." So COMPOMEX is gaining new recognition as an organization now responsible Stern, a key player in Chicago's immigrant rights movement and a crucial agent in promoting the U.S. political incorporation of the emergent migrant community. Most notably, Chicago's March 10th mobilization sparked immigrants' collective resistance to Sensenbrenner that will come to the forefront of the nation's awareness as synchronized national rallies took place on May 2006. Chicago HTA and its Home for Mexico Coalition, traditionally serving as non-confrontational, transnational, Mexican-focused organizations, transformed into vehicles of collective protest on behalf of U.S. immigrant rights. A combination of various factors can be seen as contributors to Chicago's HTA evolution. An increasingly precarious economic mobility opportunities for the escalating numbers of unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. Punitive immigration policy that maintains a vast amount of migrants in deportable status. A heightening consciousness among immigrant groups about their rights. Multi-level immigrant organizations and alliances like OMBAMEX, like NAILAC. And a growing trend of both Mexican and now local U.S. officials, particularly state governors and mayors, sensitive to growing Latino immigrant constituencies to reach out to immigrants as esteemed workers and contributors to both their standing and receiving society. Overall, the dominant use of the transnational paradigm to conceptualize HTA is no longer sufficient to adequately analyze the recent evolution to include U.S. immigrant rights concerns. Transnational studies are unable to provide satisfactory attention to how multiple state influences are shaping immigrant organizational agenda, especially U.S. state influences. And future research of HTA and the broader local leadership coalition would benefit from applying official movement paradigm, as it offers more compelling explanation of the conditional and interactive nature between government action at multiple levels and within two different countries, and the extension of COMEX leadership decisions to include both Mexico and U.S. focused concerns. The social movement paradigm, as is used in my broader dissertation project, also provides insight into how HTA's contentious activity can serve as a transformation for immigrants and their organizations to begin serving as agents for U.S. global corporations.